From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, I say farewell and hello to Stateside's new host, April Baer.
I cannot think of a better time to be talking with people from Michigan about what's going on and how they're getting by.
Looking back on radio over my 40 years.
You need to wake up in the morning, you need a good laugh, you need to feel like you're going to face the day, not alone. And you look for a bunch of people or a person that you can really relate to.
A talk with my mentor, radio legend, Jim Harper.
I think every woman in broadcasting, whether it's on the air or off the air, behind the scenes, writing, producing, whatever, they owe you a little bit of a nod because you were a groundbreaking performer at that time.
And writers Des Cooper and Keith Taylor.
You were neither here nor there, a hurry through which known and strange things pass.
Those stories and more today on Stateside. Hello, and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. 40 years ago this month, December 1979, Jimmy Carter was our president, William Milliken, Michigan's governor, and Coleman Young, Detroit's mayor. And that is when I landed my first job in radio at Detroit religious station WMUZ, 1 a.m. to 8 a.m., six mornings a week. As excited as I was at the prospect of launching a radio career, I was equally terrified because I was learning on the job in the middle of the night. As I drove to the station, nervous, afraid, I would pop in my cassette tape of The Who for just one song. There was just something about Pete Townsend's lyrics and Roger Daltrey's swaggering vocals that kept me from turning around, going home, and calling this whole broadcast thing off. And it worked. I didn't chicken out and go home. And 40 years later, as I step into retirement, I can say it has been rich, it's been challenging, it's been an exciting career in radio and TV. And there have been enormous changes in radio in these decades. So let's talk radio then and now. With us, writer Jim McFarlane, who spent many years with the Detroit News, including as media critic, and Steve Schramm, executive director and general manager of Michigan Public Media. He's our head guy here at Michigan Radio, but he began his long radio career as a DJ in the Detroit area, and he's our wizard about all things radio. Steve, give me a few words to describe radio, especially commercial radio, 40 years ago versus today.
Well, I think it's quite different, Cindy. I think that back in that time, if you start in 79, which is the year we're referencing, even all the way through the 80s, the Detroit area was in quite an exciting, dynamic, competitive arena. There weren't as many, while there were corporate ownerships of radio stations, they weren't as clamped down as they are today. Mm-hmm. There was certainly more live radio in terms of people on the air through at least till midnight, and many stations midnight to 6 a.m. as well. Today, that has changed dramatically, as has the ownership dimensions of how many stations are owned by one group and how they are commonly dictated in terms of their program format, the music that they play, announcers that are piped in from other stations across the country. So, yes, what I think all that has done for public radio is giving us great opportunity.
Yeah.
And I think that that is what has distinguished the ability for Michigan radio and other public radio stations across the state to see growth that has come as the dimensions of commercial radio have become less competitive.
Jim McFarlane, I get the feeling as I read comments on the Facebook page with all the listeners who were there for St. James and Harper at WNIC in the 80s, and then the Magic Morning Show when we launched that in 2001, and the Breakfast Club. I get a lot of people going, there's nothing like you guys anymore. How has it changed for the consumer, for the listener?
Well, I think that's very true, Cindy. I think that to jump off of what Steve said, I started in 79 when I came to Detroit, and I was railing with the FCC. You can't have this situation where a small group of owners own a lot of stations in the same market because there's no way to compete. There's no reason to compete. And what you got is a lot of that personality radio just became down to one show for like six different stations, and you lose all that competitive effect. It used to be so good. I was in Detroit radio at the best possible time, you know, back in the 70s and the 80s when, you know, you had JP and you had all these great talents. You had Harper and Harper and St. James and Harper and Gannon and Harper and you and Harper and whoever was on the mic at the time. And that's gone. You know, I mean, there's still personality. It's just not the same because there's really no competition left anymore.
I stop and I kind of think of that era you're referring to in force. Actually, throughout the state of Michigan, people would know J.P. McCarthy on WGR. I used to fill in on that station. I would get phone calls from Kentucky. I mean, that station had some reach. But my goodness, you had John Mason on WJLB, Dick Purton and Purton's people, Jim Harper, and all these permutations of the show as he had different partners. What do you think made a radio morning show something that listeners just jumped in to tune in the morning for?
I think more than anything else, they're looking for someone they can relate to. What makes radio such a great medium, I've always said, is you can take it in the bathroom with you. You know, you can take it in the car with you. It's part of you. And if you got a voice or a person or a show or a group of people on the air that you really relate to, that make you feel like you're part of their group. You know, we all want inclusion. We want to feel we're part of a larger body. And you've got so many morning teams that do just, you know, you need to wake up in the morning. You need a good laugh. You need to feel like you're going to face the day, not alone. You look for a bunch of people or a person that you can really relate to. And we had some such great talents. I mean, I feel blessed to have known and spent time with Joe McCarthy. I think he was my gold standard. When I would do radio, I'd think about what would JP do? Because he always sounded like he read the book. He always sounded like he knew the guest. He always sounded prepared. And a lot of shows today just don't have that kind of, whether they do it or not, they don't give you the impression that they do.
All those names that Cindy was mentioning earlier, whether it be Jim Harper and Dick Purton, certainly, and even John Mason, I had the good fortune of managing all those individuals at various spaces in my commercial career.
Oh my goodness.
And one of the things that I walked away from was the work ethic that those personalities put into their program. They just did not sashay in at 5 to 6 a.m. They had a team working around them that the day before trying to set up that show. They had ensembles like the Breakfast Club that Cindy was in a critical part of that really helped raise the host. And Purton did the same thing with Purton's people as well.
Yeah, no question.
So when you see that kind of effort, that kind of investment, and that level of talent that's put into programming, that's what resonated with listeners, and that's why it lifted the stations that they were on for the whole day.
Interesting things that developed toward the end of my time in commercial radio. When I think that when I began in 1979, it was to do 10 minutes of news overnight at 2, 3, 4, 5 a.m., because it was a religious radio station that wanted the daytime free for the money-making stuff. But that was when you were required to do a certain level of news and a certain amount of public affairs. That went away because my last year, I didn't do any news. I just did a little traffic and a little weather.
That was certainly atypical back then. Mm-hmm. And it's you're right. The FCC has kind of loosened all of that restriction and redefined it. And I think because a number of things have occurred. We talked about the ownership consolidation and perhaps how some of the influence of those companies made changes on the rules. I think you saw the birth of satellite radio. And what that did is adding an additional factor of where people could find listenership. And now you have online stations all over the globe. And the amount of variety of sources that are out there for content are incredible. So I think that things have changed so dramatically from what we're referencing back in the late 70s and early 80s and has made it a lot more interesting. I think at the end of the day, what we are trying to do right now in public radio, you've been with us now, Cindy, 7 years, and thank you for tremendous contribution in leading stateside. I think public radio has had the chance to take that mantle and take it seriously in terms of news and information coverage and really providing a better information service for the citizens of the state of Michigan.
Right. Especially now, and especially in these times, and maybe for all times to come, you need to have a source you can go to. And I think that public radio has created such a bond of trust with its listeners that they know they can go there and find something that's straight news, unbiased. And that's important these days in this era. Everybody's calling everybody else fake news. It's great to have a source you can go to and really feel comfortable knowing that you're getting the straight dope, so to speak.
You know, it's been 113 years since the first radio broadcast for entertainment at music was transmitted from Brant Rock, Massachusetts, to the general public. Certainly some things have changed in the 40 years since I first went behind the mic. What do you both think radio of the future is going to mean to listeners?
I think it's going to continue to be more personal. in so many different ways as it can be, certainly with online experiences. But I do think at the end of the day, which is what I think has stood the test of time, is how well the content is curated, how well it is presented, how well it informs, how well it entertains. It doesn't really matter what the distribution channel is or the distribution method. It matters about the humanity of what is in the message. It matters about the personality and how they resonate with the person on the other end. It still, in many ways, is a one-to-one medium, even though it's been one-to-many in terms of the broadcast impact. When it really relates to the person who's on the other end of receiving that, they feel it's one-to-one, and that's when you've become successful.
What do you see in your crystal ball, Jim McFarland?
Radio at its best is you talking to me. There's no one else in the world except the guy on the radio or the woman on the radio and me. It's that one-to-one connection. And if it's an ensemble cast, you're all performing for me. I am the king of my car, and you are playing your play for me. And that may never go away. People keep talking about the death of radio. Radio's not going anywhere, but it will continue to change and evolve, and it will conform to the needs of its listeners. And I think that there's so much competition. As Steve said, you got online, you got satellite, but if you want to know what's going on down the street, or you want to know if your high school team won tonight, you're not going to a satellite. You're going to your local radio station to find that out. And there'll always be that need to have a source that can talk to you, A, and give you local information, B.
Well, I have to say, in my 40 years, you've both played a very, very big role. From the bottom of my heart, Steve Schramm, thank you for inviting me here to Michigan Radio. As our mutual friend Dick Kernan of Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts said to me, you know you've died and gone to broadcast heaven, don't you? And the answer is, yes, I have. And Jim McFarland, I owe you a special thanks because in 1984, you bestowed your coveted Big Mac Awards on a whole bunch of us at WNIC. And boy, did you make our bosses happy with us. So,
well, you deserved it, first of all. I just want to say before you got here, you are, Cindy Canty, going to be dearly missed in this market. There is no one I know who is as universally liked, respected, and admired as Cynthia Canty. And if you don't know Cindy Canty personally, if you're one of the 7,000 people who've been interviewed by her, but you don't know her, that is your loss, because she is one outstanding human being and a credit to profession.
And I want to add one thing to that, Jim. Probably one of the most prideful things that I've ever done being here at Michigan Radio almost in 14 years is hiring Cindy. In 2012, we have certainly worked together during our time at WNIC when NIC was number one in the market. And
that's
for
right.
The opportunity to bring her here and to introduce her to a public radio marketplace and audience that has just loved her and embraced her for these past 7 years. What a point of pride that is for me and for our station.
Steve Schramm, Jim McFarland, hugs to both of you. Thank you for being on my final show.
Take care and best wishes, Cindy.
Thank you, Cindy. Enjoy your time in court.
And coming up, I'll speak with two of my favorite Michigan authors about writing new chapters in the book of life.
I just woke up one day and said, what's a good girl like me doing in a place like this?
Transitions and new beginnings after the break. This is Stateside. Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. I have talked to thousands of interesting, fascinating people, and often wish I could get some of them around a dinner table. So we're doing a few of my dream dinner conversations this week, and two very special dinner guests are here with me now. The first is a 2015 Kresge Artist Fellow, a former attorney, a Pulitzer Prize-nominated journalist, a poet, filmmaker, community activist. I loved her beautiful collection of flash fiction, Know the Mother. Desiree Cooper, welcome to my dinner party.
Thank you. I'm full already, full of sadness that you're leaving us.
Oh, thank you.
This can't be happening.
Oh, thank you, thank you. And also here at the party, poet, writer, teacher, wonderful guy, Keith Taylor. We've had him on Stateside through the years offering seasonal book picks, and my favorite moments have been you reading excerpts to us. Now, Keith is retired from the University of Michigan, where he taught creative writing, and you both have such powerful voices in your writing, so thank you for being here today.
Thanks for asking us.
It's an honor
to be here on your way out.
Oh, thank you. Desiree, I'm interested because you've both followed fascinating paths to where you are now in your writing careers. When did the writing bug bite you, Desiree?
I mean, I've never wanted to be anything but a writer. As soon as I could, well, I guess before I could read for myself, but having stories read to me, books have been endless sources of fascination. I read so much that was my parents decided to pay me, so that was my summer job. I got paid by the book.
So you earned a nice salary reading.
Oh, I broke them. I broke them. But it's just people now, when I go out to speak, you know, people say like, well, what are you reading? What's your most influential book? And I always just, I can't come up with that impressive answer. It is Charlotte's Web. You know, It is Charlotte's Web. It is the book that just took me out of myself and into a different world, into imagination, was so precious. I cried and cried and cried when Charlotte died. The emotion, the empathy, that was just profound. And I'm not sure any other book has measured up since.
Boy, I was much the same. Charlotte's Web did it for me. And then I used to go to the Ferndale Library and they had the summer reading game. Run to the library on my bike and get books at a time. For me, it was Laura Ingalls Wilder.
Yeah.
It's for my wife,
absolutely.
Too.
Your wife as well, Keith?
Yes, absolutely. City girl, so reading all that stuff about the prairie. Mm-hmm.
Oh, my goodness. Absolutely. And you, Keith, what about
you? Well, I knew you were going to ask me since you were just Desiree. I have to say, and it's tough for me to admit this since I'm not a very actively religious person now, but my father was a minister in a very conservative denomination, and we had no money out there in the Canadian prairie. And one of the things that, you know, the book that was always part of our daily life was the Bible in the King James translation. And to go to summer camp, I could go free if I memorized 300 verses. So between the ages of 5 and 12, every summer, I memorized 300 verses of the Bible.
Wow.
And that language has shaped me. I wish it were more fun. I wish my story were more fun, but I know it was the Bible in the King James translation.
Well, but it could hardly be more beautiful. I mean, the lyricism of the Bible, the Psalms, you know,
I mean, and some of the stories.
And some of the stories.
Especially the Old Testament stories.
Yeah,
they're fabulous.
I use the language for titles. And I used to tell my students when I taught, when they said, I can't find a title. And I said, well, go look in the Bible. The Bible or Shakespeare, that's the great place for titles.
You know what, Keith? You just reminded me of something. You know how people are now, it's sort of like you go into a room and you have to express what your pronouns are. And somebody said that mine are thee, thou, thine.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
I love that.
I do, too.
Like, why didn't I think of that?
Right. We could all be Quakers. You know, my father, when he did get an actual BA, it was in Greek. So he could read the Bible in the original. And after I got pretty good at a couple of Romance languages, I asked him once whether he thought the thee and thou that he would use in his prayers, if he thought that was an act of honor or an act of intimacy. And he said, even though he knew the structures of language, he said it was an act of honor. And I said, no, it's intimacy. That's the second person singular, like tu in French. You know, that's the old vestige of that in English. And it's like, wow.
Okay, so translating for normal people, what you're saying is that's more like the familiar address is not formal address.
Exactly. That's what you say to your children, your parents, your lovers, your best friends.
Now you got that. Thee and thou, Desiree, that's beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, I know, Des, you were an attorney, and my daughter is going through law school now, and I've watched her, you know, learning this new way of writing, and legal thinking. And my goodness, that's so tremendously different from the kind of creative writing you did, you know, like for, let's say, Know the Mother. How do you reconcile that?
I went through a recovery program.
Recovering attorney. And you stopped practicing law, didn't you, after you had your first child?
I did. I practiced for about 5 years, and I think it's telling that I left the practice of law. I did not go to a different law firm or do something different in law. Like, I completely walked away from it. And I just woke up one day and said, what's a good girl like me doing in a place like this? I just couldn't. And the lack of, for me, it really was a straitjacket. There was just such little creativity. And I am not kidding. I really did have to unlearn the violence they did to the English language for law school.
Keith, your path, I was unaware until I went kind of digging around and found, you've got to walk us through the kinds of jobs that you held as you, you know, got off, you started in British Columbia and you said you grew up on the prairie. Walk us through the myriad list of jobs you've held.
Yeah, I keep that long list on there because these days everybody's biographies sound the same.
Yours writers, does not. You
know, right. It's I went to school. I won these awards. Yeah. I have this job. Because I came from no money and because I wanted to do something different, there was no way all that was going to happen unless I paid for it myself. So I worked as a house painter. When I went to Europe, I was working illegally. It's easier now for young North Americans to work in Europe than it was then. I washed dishes in a restaurant for 80 cents an hour. In southern France, yes. Painted houses in Ireland. I was assistant at a summer school at Cambridge. So, I mean, that was a hoity-toity job. Mm-hmm. Didn't pay very much money. Came back to the States, did all kinds of things again as a house painter. Sort of the last big job I had when my mother, other than, you know, professional job, when my mother was ill in the early 80s, I went to California to be with her until she passed. And I was a night manager of a pinball arcade in Southern California. So I liked to have all these jobs. And then I was a bookseller in Ann Arbor for 20 years before the university hired me. These helped me connect with people. These, as a writer, this is great stuff. I had a great time.
If you just join me, I am here having a wonderful dinner party style conversation with two magnificent writers, Keith Taylor and Desiree Cooper. And Desiree, Keith just mentioned going to California to care for his mother. And I know right now you're going through the experience of being there for aging parents. And your mother has Alzheimer's because I know you shared on social media a moment when your mother looked at you and asked you, who is your mother? Yeah. What did that moment feel like?
That's just a kick in the gut on a couple levels. First of all, that never stops being your mommy. And you're never not the daughter, the little girl. Mm-hmm. So to have your mother not recognize you as her child is awful. But here's the thing that got me most is that my mother's pride and joy, her aspiration, her vocation was motherhood. And she gave that 1,000%. So for her to look at a person that she gave birth to and raised and gave her all to and not recognize that person as the fruit of her, you know, literal labor, mm-hmm. and not recognize herself as the mother of that child was, whoa. I mean, she had not only forgotten me, she'd forgotten herself. Yeah. And I almost just lost it. I mean, I've been at this now, and actually, Cindy, both of my parents have Alzheimer's.
Oh, boy.
And so I moved in with them about 3.5 years ago. I left Detroit 30 years and moved in with them in the Virginia Beach area. And so it has been, you know, now I'm a little bit more hard-boiled, and the surprises keep coming. I guess I might just be a little bit more able to roll with what life is bringing now. That has been, I am a very type A person, and that has been slapped out of me in the last 3 years. You cannot be goal-oriented, task-oriented, what's going to happen, what's going to get done, and take care of two seniors with Alzheimer's at the same time. You have got to be a lot more zen about life.
I think that actually, I love that phrase, Desiree, that you've got the type A slapped out of you. Because I think there's a lot of us that could use some of that type A getting slapped out of us a little bit. What do you think, Keith?
Well, you know, I've never been very type A, so I don't know. I could use a little more of it slapped into me, but it's probably too late now. But Des, I just want to say, I mean, it's I assume your mother was with us in mentally long enough to realize your success and how successful she was as a mother, because clearly her commitment to mothering worked. So,
and now that's so sweet.
And now you're mothering her.
And now I'm mothering her, and she actually, you know, she did not sort of stay aware enough to see me publish my first book. That's not really she supported me as a writer all along. Yeah. I don't know. But anyway, here I am now. It's like a completely different journey, as you are, Cindy, about to embark upon.
I am excited.
What's that going to look like for you?
It's going to look like we have a little cottage in Ireland because I was lucky enough to marry a man from Cork City 43 years ago. And we bought that cottage 22 years ago to be able to make his mom and dad feel better when we would leave, because it was heart-wrenching. If you're busy falling in love with somebody from across the pond, you're not thinking about the fact that no matter where you live, somebody's heart's going to be broken because you're living across the ocean.
Right.
So when we bought that little cottage not too far from Cork City, it seemed to help his mom and dad with kind of the goodbyes.
Great.
Now they're both gone, but we've had this for 22 years. And for 22 years, I go over there in this piece of heaven overlooking the ocean, and I feel myself there, the most myself when I'm in that spot. But it's like 2 weeks, bing, down, back on the plane.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
The night before I leave, I would sit on the fence post, because we're lucky enough to be in the country. So to the south, you have a vista of ocean. And then to the north, you have the valleys and the fields that lead up to the mountains between Cork and Kerry. And on a beautiful sunset evening, if it's not raining, if the sun is setting, I would sit on that porch the last night before we're leaving and cry, because I don't know when I'll be back. So part of the plan is, God willing, as long as the health holds out, because that's another lesson you learn as the years go on. Yeah. And if you can wake up healthy and go to sleep without some awful phone call from a doctor, it's a good thing. So healthy, got this place. So I've already booked a 7-week stay in the spring.
Wonderful.
By myself.
Oh, good. Great. By yourself?
By myself. Because my husband's going to keep working for a while. He's not ready, but I said, I am. So I'm like, you can come visit me if you want or not. Listen, one of the things I've loved in these years of stateside is when writers read to us. Whenever anybody who has poured their heart and soul into words opens up that book and reads to us, it feels like I'm being wrapped in a blankie, probably because my father read to me when I was tiny and I'd sit on his lap. I've got pictures when I was 1 year old, read to me constantly. So I would love, Desiree, would you read something to us?
Yeah, so this is a piece of flash fiction that you will recognize as coming right out of my experience now, but I'm dedicating it to you, Cindy.
Oh, thank you.
And it's called Waste Not. My parents are old and inert. Their bodies want only to be still. There's not much we can do for entertainment except sit here, and then for a change of scenery, sit there. When the weather is nice, and sometimes even when the rain is warm and gentle, I lift up the garage door and arrange the cushioned lawn chairs so that they can sit just inside the lip and watch the neighbors come and go. Sometimes we sip Cokes, sometimes we snack. Sometimes we have music, a little Motown or Boots Randolph to help us mark the time. But mostly we sit for hours and say nothing, or else listen to the rolling tide of my father's repetitious questions. I remember all those years when time was my enemy, invisible and cruel like gravity. It would barrel forward so furiously I had no idea where it went. As soon as I'd awaken, it would already feel blown. It passed in a gust of overwhelm. It had breath but no weight. It had seasons but no flavor. My parents and I are closer to the end of our lives than to the beginning. If anyone, we should know better than to throw away our uncertain measure that we have left. We should be scurrying and feathering, scrimping and stretching, but we aren't. Time now stretches languid in the humid afternoon, shimmering just above the hot asphalt. It tastes like caramel cake. It smells like pine needles in the rain. It looks like every second a different thing, as light goes a little higher, then lower, white, then yellow, then crimson, then indigo. We have learned something. Our days cannot be hoarded, only spent. And in these last luxurious hours, we are rich. We spend as much time as we want.
Beautiful.
Thank you. Thank you, Desiree. That was just gorgeous. And in fact, I would love, is that in your book?
That is brand new.
Brand new.
I will send you a copy. I want you to take it with you to Ireland.
I will.
You have that 7 weeks.
Please do. Keith?
Well, when I knew I was coming here and I knew you'd ask me to read something, I do have new work, but I thought I would read an Irish poem. So I have two Irish poems with me. I think the one in the book right now is the one that's seeming most appropriate to me because, you know, you, Cindy, Ireland, all of those things. So this is a Seamus Heaney poem. Mm-hmm. From a book of his called The Spirit Level. Back in the days, Heaney died, a decade or so ago, maybe more now. This is the west of Ireland. It's not County Cork, but it is that sense of the wind constantly blowing out there along the ocean side in Ireland, and it gets it better than most things, I think. The poem is called Postscript. And sometime make the time to drive out west into County Clare along the flaggy shore in September or October when the wind and the light are working off each other so that the ocean on one side is wild with foam and glitter and inland among stones the surface of a slate-gray lake is lit by the earthed lightning of a flock of swans, their feathers ruffed and ruffling, white on white, their fully grown, headstrong-looking heads tucked or cresting or busy underwater. Useless to think you'll park and capture it more thoroughly. You are neither here nor there, a hurry through which known and strange things pass, as big, soft buffetings come at the car sideways and catch the heart off guard and blow it open.
Well, my, beautiful. Keith Taylor and Desiree Cooper, thank you so much.
Thank you, Cindy.
And thank you for your service to this community.
Absolutely.
It's been amazing. Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Coming up, I end my career on radio where I began in a conversation with my friend, my mentor, Jim Harper.
That's one of the things that makes you unique is you really thrive on talking to people, bringing out the best in people, interacting with people, learning and teaching.
Jim Harper leaves retirement for just a few minutes to talk about what awaits me off air. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. So you ask, just who will be sitting in the Stateside host chair now that I'm retiring? Well, it is my pleasure now to introduce you to Stateside's new host, April Bear, and I say this with all of my heart, April Bear, welcome to Stateside.
Cindy, I cannot say how happy I am to be here with you, and it's such a thrill to be taking over and filling those big shoes.
Well, thank you. And I know, I want people to get to know you a little bit. You come to us from quite a few years in Oregon Public Broadcasting, but let's go further back than that. You are a Midwesterner.
Yes, it's true. We don't say this in polite company, but I am from the state of Ohio.
Okay, we won't hold that again.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to be truthful, I mean, there is quite a lot of shared DNA, especially around Ann Arbor, and you get to Northwest Ohio. Mm-hmm. There's so much overlap in culture and just in geography and families, and our family is part of that.
Very much so. And you had the good luck to fall in love with a Michigander.
Yes. My husband grew up in Ann Arbor, has family in both Ann Arbor, Dexter area, and also in Marquette, the aunties and uncles and his grandma. And yes, he's a graduate of the University of Michigan, so we are a mixed marriage, as they say.
Give us an idea of some of the roles that you've held in public radio through the years.
Right. So my superpower was getting up at 3:00 in the morning. So my thing was morning shifts for many years. I worked a morning edition shift in Yellow Springs, Ohio, in Cleveland for several years. And then ultimately that was what took me to Oregon, was working on the statewide affiliate there for morning shift. Then I'd always done reporting, but I graduated to government affairs beat, legal affairs, military affairs. Also threw in some arts and culture and things on the changing demography of Oregon. And then for the past 6 years, I've been hosting an arts and culture show called State of Wonder. And that was a place where we looked at really what was going on everywhere in the world through the lens of the arts.
And what excites you most about this new job here on Stateside?
Well, I mean, getting back to news is huge. And let's just say it, getting back to news in 2020, it's an important opportunity. And I cannot think of a better time to be talking with people from Michigan about what's going on and how they're getting by and what is really going through their heads as we look at the stories and processes, not just the political ones, but everything that's flowing past us in the culture right now.
And it all connects. That's the thing I think I've realized over these years.
Very much.
They are all interconnected. What do you want Stateside to be with you in the host chair?
Well, it needs to be... It needs to be the place where we can talk to each other. You know, it's the one thing that I have always, always prized above all other things is, frankly, not to steal the slogan, but that facts matter and that we're going to listen to each other, and that that is what public radio is here to do. And that's been true. It was true in the broadcast era. It's still true in the podcast era. And I feel like regional stories deserve all the care and feeding and attention that the national news often gets. And the reason that Michigan radio was an important place to me was because I saw that happening here on Stateside and with reporting coming out of the newsroom, and I wanted to be part of that.
Well, you are part of an amazing team led by JoLynn Stroth and all of our wonderful producers. There's another April, April Van Buren, Mercedes
Two
Mejia.
Two Aprils, no waiting.
Mike Blank, Laura Weber Davis, you're in great hands with this team. So Godspeed and good luck, and I will be listening. April Bear, thank you.
Well, thank you. And you'll be listening with a glass in your hand, I hope, because it wouldn't be a going away party without a good bottle of Oregon wine.
Oh, thank you.
A Pinot Noir from one of my favorite vineyards. I think it's we who should be thanking you, Cindy,
as I pass
this across the table. Mm. And don't share it. That is just for you. We really, truly stand on the shoulders of everyone who's come before us.
Thank you.
Rise and shine. There's a new day waiting for you.
That is the song thousands of Michiganders woke up to in the late 70s and the early 80s, the theme song to the St. James and Harper show on Detroit's 100.3 WNIC. And it was October 1980 when I joined Jim Harper and Jerry St. James as a newscaster and sidekick on their top-rated morning show. That was the start of a friendship and a mentorship that has shaped my career, shaped my life, working with Jim Harper, learning radio from someone who began his radio career at an extraordinarily young age. And it is now my pleasure to say, Jim Harper, welcome to Stateside, and thank you.
Well, thank you for having me on, and congratulations on your retirement from this chapter of your illustrious life.
Well, thank you. You know, how are you? That's what everybody's going to want to know. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. I'm really doing great. It's funny. I was thinking about what to say to you regarding your retirement, and I think it would be safe to say, knowing you as well as I do, you shouldn't look at this as retirement. It's retirement from this chapter.
Yeah.
Because I think, knowing you as well as I do, you will immediately appreciate the, you know, freedom and the lack of responsibility and the amount of work that you're used to going away. And then you'll take some time, you'll travel, you'll relax. But I think in a very short period of time, I would give it less than a year, you'll find yourself doing something else.
Well, thank you.
I think your next chapter will be an exciting one.
It will be. I have to ask, when I think about joining you and Jerry at WNIC in the fall of 1980, and it was like, you know, months earlier that you were my alarm when I was getting up for work at a nonprofit, listening to you, and there I was, part of the show. Did you have any idea how starstruck and terrified I was?
No, absolutely not, because you always, you know, hold yourself with such confidence and aplomb. I didn't think you were at least a bit nervous. You seemed energetic. And one of the things that people should realize, because the world has changed so much and what is now the norm at that time was really quite unusual. People don't, I think, realize that you were actually the first woman to be the part of a morning radio show in a big city anywhere. Yeah. There were no female news anchors at that time in the morning. None. Mm. Absolutely none. And there was no such thing as a female co-host or, you know, member of an ensemble. That was all brand new, groundbreaking, the kind of thing that people in suits and ties would discuss in a conference room for weeks on end to decide whether or not the public was ready for it. That was a big step forward. So I think every woman in broadcasting, whether it's on the air or off the air, behind the scenes, writing, producing, whatever, they owe you a little bit of a nod because you were a groundbreaking performer at that time.
Well, thank you. And I know you had a groundbreaking idea, and that was when I was going to have our first son, Brendan. We had him on the air. In fact, I remember you turned Brendan into a character on the show. I found a picture of you interviewing him, and Steve Gannon was off doing the Brendan Baby voice. He was part of that. But when I was going to have him, you had the idea, how about working from home? You know, knowing how many women listen to our station, and we did it. And, it, you know, now it's no big deal, but it sure was in 1984 to have a big satellite dish on your garage and a machine in your basement spitting out newswire and broadcasting from home.
And in addition to that, at that time in the 80s, there was no such thing as family leave. So it allowed you to retain your full-time salary and, you know, not have to worry about trying to make up lost wages. But it was fun. It was great fun. And you were always game for that kind of thing. And I do think it's the kind of thing that people really thought was unique. And as you know, there's nothing more successful than sharing your life with your audience.
Which we all did, you know, and I thought I was reflecting and thinking of the things we all shared, you know, births of children, loss of parents. You know, I think about even in something like daily, like my daughter's, when she was tiny, doing Irish dance competitions, we talk about. And now I stop and think that that little thing is graduating from law school next spring. When you think of the years passing, we all shared. Was it ever hard for you to be an open book, Jim, for your listeners?
No, because I always thought that it was interesting to people, and that even the most benign conversations, like you remember, we used to make this big deal about what we're going to have for breakfast.
You're right.
And you think about that. And I would have consultants and managers say to me, what the heck are you talking for 3 minutes about what you're going to order for breakfast? It never had a punchline. It never had a really salient point. But the conversation itself was so genuine. And of course, we all had a passion for good food, that people found that to be one of the most endearing things we did. Anytime we would do research, people would say, oh, I love when they talk about, you know, what they're going to have for breakfast. Or I love when Cindy talks about what she did over the weekend. You know, what's going on with her son or her daughter. People are prone to be interested in other people in all aspects. So if it's genuine, I think it's a home run. When you make it up, it's not that appealing.
You said something to me, actually, when I came back after my 10 or some years in television, and I came back to join you on The Breakfast Club, and then we became The Magic Morning Show. And I remember you saying this, and here's your quote. I don't want to get sappy here, but I see what we do as a sort of a mission. Talk about that.
Well, I didn't think it was so much a mission as I thought it was a ministry.
Yes, that was the word you used. You said a ministry. You're right. This is a ministry.
Yeah. And I think it doesn't really have religious or spiritual connotations to it. The idea of being, you have a code that you live by, you have rules that you establish. And in our case, those rules were, we want to be fun, not funny, although we often were, you know, kind of funny, but it wasn't the goal. The goal was to be fun. And also we promised ourselves we would never put a parent in an embarrassing situation if they were driving their kids to school, that they'd have to either shut the radio off or explain some
awkward thing.
some innuendo.
Yeah.
Or something like that. So when you establish those kind of parameters for what you're going to do with your life and your career, I look at it as kind of being a ministry.
Jim, when you think of the years that we shared on the air, we were on the air when 9/11 happened. And the next morning, there we were, stunned and trying to figure out, how do we do a fun show in the midst of this? And you seized on the thing that lasted for years, that you said, someone call in and lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance. And every day at 7:30, we had everything from 2-year-old toddlers to 98-year-old World War II veterans who would lead us in the Pledge of Allegiance, and everybody in between, people who were new citizens, little children who had learned it by listening to our show. What a genius idea that was, because it crystallized what we were searching for.
That's all anybody wanted, I think, at that point, from what I could tell, was to know, first of all, that we were going to be safe for the next 24 hours.
Yeah.
There was such a tremendous, I remember when the actual attack occurred, the biggest feeling was, oh my God, is it over yet? I can deal with anything, but please tell me it's not ongoing.
So from that point forward, I think people wanted to have some assurance that we were all going to be okay. And then also a connection to that ethereal sense of community and love and caring and being part of something that everybody had a basic understanding of how it worked. Everybody has their own opinions of all the ins and outs of being an American, but they certainly all agreed that doing the Pledge of Allegiance and, you know, singing along with the national anthem or something was a great way to connect. And I think connecting people at that time was obviously very important.
And connecting people is what you did all of the years on Detroit Radio. And I want to just say at this point, as I prepare to close this chapter and open a new one, I want to thank you for all you taught me about one-on-one communication, about when the great lesson that no matter what is happening in your life, you leave it outside the studio, because we owe the people listening to us our very best every day as we came in. And it was a great, great discipline to learn early in my career. And it's been a wonderful 40-year run, and I want to thank you for the huge part you've played as a mentor, but even more importantly, as my friend.
Well, I think that everybody needs to know that there really is very few people in the Detroit area who have taken radio as seriously as you do, and at the same time, be so dedicated to giving back and having a good time with it. I've never seen you be anything less than fabulous with listeners. We used to spend a lot of time signing autographs at the end of our live shows, and we didn't leave till the last person left. Even the guy walking by who didn't really know who we were, and we said, hey, you want a picture? But you would always take the time to write something personal on every single autograph. And that's something that's either there or it's not. So that's why I say to everybody listening to your final show, this will not be the last time we hear or see Cindy. It'll just take a new form.
Thank you, my friend.
All the best. God bless and Merry Christmas. And let us know what's going on so we can continue to be your biggest fan.
This is a TV 50 news update with Cynthia Canton.
Good evening, everyone. Her family's nightmare is over, but big questions remain in the Dawn McGowan case.
Fox 50 Cynthia Canty now joins us live. And Cindy, I imagine it's just a bunch of hard work down there tonight, huh?
They've got to roll out 600 cars, and they've got to do it by tomorrow morning. I'll tell you what, I'm standing right here. If I don't get run over by a forklift truck, it's going to be an absolute miracle.
And welcome back. We are here with Father William Cunningham of Focus Hope, and also Borkowski and Rosa Hosky. How did I do, guys?
Very good.
Thanks for making the switch with Jim Harper, Linda Lancey, and Cindy Canty to the Motor City's new radio station. This is WMG.
If your doctor says, get this patient on a banana bag, what does that mean?
On a banana bag. An IV? IV drip?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. IV drip, please.
From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, a conversation with Michigan's Governor Rick Snyder.
And so it is time to put a bow on my 40 years on radio and TV. Thank yous are certainly in order to the entire Michigan Radio team. It has been the honor of a lifetime to be in your company. Special love to Steve Schramm for bringing me here, to Zoe and Joe, and the many gifted producers who've crafted and shaped Stateside over the years. Stateside listeners may hear me do the interviews, but believe me when I tell you it is a true team effort, finding topics, getting background material, editing the interviews. It does take a village to create every day's program. Thanks to radio's best friend, Art Volo, for the archival clips. And then thank you to my family, my husband, Sean, who did not flinch when I turned our schedules inside out to work 1 a.m. to 8 a.m. six mornings a week for that first radio job. Thanks to our daughter, Siobhan, son, Brendan, our daughter-in-law, Megan, for all the times I talked about you on the radio or had to kiss you goodnight via cell phone from the TV news truck, or I wasn't there for special events because I worked weird hours. Thank you. I'm so looking forward to spending more time with our three grandchildren, Liam, Bridget, and Rory, and being there for hockey, Irish dance, and story time. And to those of you who invited me into your day, every time you've tuned in, thank you. Your presence in my life has been a gift through births, graduations, school plays, dance competitions, empty nesting, losing parents, finding my birth mother, and more. You are part of the family. Please stay in touch. I'm on Facebook, Cindy Canty. That's Cindy with two Y's. Twitter, @CindyCanty, and Instagram, Psycan 53. Join me 3 p.m. January 6th as we all listen to and welcome April Baer as she takes Stateside into its new chapter. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so very much for listening.